This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. There's an election on and everyone is making big promises. Some of them are to be funded by taxing the rich. But who are the rich? People who earn more? People who own more? Is a Londoner on 40k really richer than a Cumbrian on 30k? And will the next Chancellor be able to get the money they need from high earners, or will they have to find new ways of funding their ambitions? Experts on tax and wealth are making their way into the briefing room. Let's find out what they have to say. And if you enjoy this podcast, you're likely to enjoy some of our other episodes, including ones on Brexit, meat eating and Syria. You can find them all on BBC Sounds. Never in the field of electioneering has so much been promised to so many at the apparent cost to so few. Well, not for a while, anyway. But there's a problem. We've been told there'll be additional borrowing, and in the case of Labour, that the wealthy will pay some more. But who exactly are the wealthy? Can the people we tend to think of as the rich meet the cost of the politicians' ambitions? And if they can't, who else might pay, and in what ways? The answers may not be the ones you're expecting, so let's step inside the briefing room and find out. First, the sound of a voter discovering he's better off than he thought, although he doesn't sound very happy about it.
Because I've read your policy. It's above £80,000. And I am nowhere near in the top 5%, let me tell you. I'm not even in the top 50%.
So you earn over £80,000?
Yes, and I'm not in the top 5%.
That was an exchange from last week's Question Time. Whatever that audience member's personal circumstances, his perception of who the wealthy people are in Britain got me thinking. Just who is rich? And do our ideas of who are the best off correspond with the facts? Time to crunch some data. Earlier I was joined in the briefing room by Torsten Bell, Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation. It's an independent think tank that focuses on those living on low and middle incomes. Torsten Bell, that audience member that everybody's been talking about, was he right to claim that the fact he earned 80k didn't mean he was in the top 5% of earners?
No, is the straightforward but overly simplified answer. He is definitely in the top 5% of earners. He's in the top 5% of earners for the country as a whole, and he's certainly in the top 5% of earners in Bolton, where the show was taking place.
Why might somebody like him feel that he wasn't?
Firstly, things have been rubbish for everybody for the last decade. The pay squeeze that's happened past the financial crisis means that actually today we are only just getting back to the level of pay we all had in 2008. And that pay squeeze has actually squeezed everybody. Rich, poor, middle, bottom, everybody's been stuffed by it. And so it's not that surprising that people might feel things are tough, even if they're on high incomes. Then you come to who do people spend their lives with? So if you're on £80,000, maybe you are a lawyer or a GP or an accountant. You spend time with lots of other people who are lawyers, GPs and accountants. Maybe you do think 80,000 is a pretty normal income. So we all, and that isn't just about pretty well off people. We all think that we are more normal.
What is the average income?
The average earnings, how much people actually earnings is around £25,000.
And what's the average household income?
That's a little bit higher. The average household income is probably now around £27,000 to £30,000. Although incomes are obviously covering the whole household and take into account lots of people who don't have earnings. So the people who don't appear in the earnings distribution that do appear in the income distribution. Pensioners, for example, or people that are in workless households.
Okay. Is he as well off, let's say, as a Londoner earning £100,000?
there are really interesting regional differences. So on earnings, yes, the obvious things are true, which is in London, people have higher earnings and have higher incomes than the country as a whole. But, and this is a really important but, costs matter as well as what you actually bring in. And because housing costs are so much higher in London and in other some other places than they are in other parts of the country, actually, London is below average living standards now once we take into account housing costs. So yes, big earnings gaps. Somebody on £80,000 in London is still well off for London, but they're definitely not going to feel rich because they're going to face very high housing costs compared to the rest of the country.
Somebody in his position, the man in Bolton's position, might have, let's say, what is it, nearly four times the average wage, but he is not even on the same planet as the people we tend to describe as being really rich.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. When people talk about the rich, they mean bankers, they talk about the plutocrats, they've got private jets in mind. They're really talking not about the top 5%, not really even about the top 1%. They're really talking about the top 0.1 or 0.5% of the country. There's not many of these people. Those people are really rich. And really importantly, that is the group that did particularly well in getting more of the income pie during the 2000s. They did well also in the 1980s and 1990s, when in general inequality was rising. But the bit of inequality that went up in the 2000s is principally about the very top, who none of us have really met very often, having a lot more money. Those people have almost nothing in common with somebody earning £80,000 in Bolton. And the person on £80,000 is really rich for the country, a high earner for the country as a whole, but they've never met those people. They have nothing in common with them. Their lifestyles have nothing in common. And actually, in lots of ways, they will have much more in common with someone, as you say, who they do earn three times more than them, but someone who's on median typical earnings.
What proportion of people are on the average 22,000?
Half of the population of workers is earning between 15 and 38,000 pounds. So most of us are bunched in that general area. And then you start stretching out once you move above that.
Is our 80,000 man typical in thinking that he's poorer than actually he is?
Richer people do generally think that the country as a whole is higher income. So we all assume that the world is more like us than it is. So yes, that is not an abnormal thing to think. And it's not abnormal for people even who are quite high income to think that there are people right at the top who are really getting away with murder. So yeah, I think he represents a reasonably good... He's a good illustration of the state of Britain in the 21st century.
Torsten Bell. That's who has the money and who hasn't. Bear this in mind when we think about what the country is going to need if the two main political parties carry out their promises. As ever, they claim that their wish lists have been fully costed. But have they been fully budgeted? Earlier today, Paul Johnson, director of the highly respected Institute for Fiscal Studies, gave a distinctly no-sounding answer to that question.
Neither is really being honest about what it takes to run a sort of welfare state on the scale that either of them are talking about. So the Conservatives have said no increases in national insurance, VAT and income tax. If we're going to continue to spend more on health and schools and so on, we will at some point need to do something with the tax system. We can't just pretend it can stay the same forever. And on Labour, well, look, they're talking about, as I say, a massive increase in the role and scale and scope of the state, which, you know, is manageable in the long run. But I think people shouldn't take at face value the idea that nobody on, you know, less than £80,000 will be made worse off by their tax proposals.
Paul Johnson of the IFS. The way things stand, you could imagine a Chancellor of the Exchequer faced with a huge dilemma in a year or two's time. Do we drop these big promises? Or do I find the extra money from somewhere, from someone? Let's suppose the promises win. Where could the country get the dough? I'm joined in the briefing room by Pat Thane, Research Professor in Contemporary History at King's College London, on the line from Edinburgh by Merrin Somerset Webb, the editor-in-chief of the personal finance magazine Money Week, and by John Whiting, the former tax director of the Government's Office of Tax Simplification. Merrin Somerset Webb, one of the first things anybody says about all this is, let's just borrow more. Cost of borrowing's low, whatever it is that we need and whatever the shortfall is, borrow it. What are the limitations on borrowing?
Well, the first thing to say is that's a very, very compelling argument at the moment, with interest rates extremely low, and we've already experimented with quantitative easing with no obvious effect on inflation. So it becomes incredibly tempting to say we can simply borrow everything we need indefinitely. And also to say that if you have control of your own currency, you can't ever default on it because you can always pay back your debt by printing more, so it doesn't matter how much you borrow. However, it does come under too good to be true, because in the end, if you continue to borrow at very high levels, you will drive higher interest rates, and then you'll crowd out private borrowing, which has an effect on the economy, obviously, and eventually you will also force inflation. So in the end, debt has to be paid back by somebody.
And when we did have high inflation, we didn't like it, did we?
We didn't like it at all, and we won't like it next time round either.
So if we can't go a long way down the borrowing route, what else might we do? John Whiting, what do other countries who try to give a high proportion of their GDP to public expenditure, what do they do in order to get themselves there?
Well, the trite answer is obviously higher taxes, and usually various permutations of all the classic taxes. Because as you look around the developed countries, they all use income tax, social security, national insurance to us, VAT or similar, corporation tax, etc., etc. There are one or two taxes that countries will use that we don't, such as a wealth tax. But in the main, they are just raising more out of those classics. So countries like Belgium, France to a degree, much higher social security than we have. Sweden, legendarily a high tax country, generally high income taxes. A lot of the Eastern European countries actually just don't raise so much because they don't have so much state expenditure.
So somewhere like Sweden, what kind of basic level of income tax are you paying?
Well, you can very easily be on higher rates than us, 50-60%. And the deal is, of course, Sweden legendarily raises higher taxes, but very few people will spend money on private education, private healthcare, because the state provision is good.
You raised the question, John, about what we've done historically. I think that allows me to ask Pat Thane. We have had periods since the war, haven't we, where we've had a significantly greater share of the economy taken by public expenditure. How did we fund it then?
Well, there's a big rise after the Second World War, of course.
Because?
Well, partly it's the welfare state setting up the National Health Service, expanding pensions and other benefits, and nationalisation of key industries like railways and mines, and investment in the economy in order to bring about full employment, which they thought was the most important contribution to improving welfare. If everyone's got a job at decent pay, and then that worked, and they introduced full employment, it remained until the 1970s, and it did greatly improve living standards.
But in the first instance, who actually paid for it?
A mixture of things. I mean, they introduced a universal national insurance payment for the first time. Previously, it'd been very restricted. So every working person is paying a regular national insurance contribution, which helped to fund social security improvements. Taxes became more steeply graduated. The threshold was raised, and most manual workers didn't pay income tax, not really until the early 70s. But the higher levels of tax were raised. Surtax was raised on incomes above £10,000, which sounds like nothing now, but was a very high income in those days. And there were also increases on what were then called death duties, but now it's called inheritance tax, which went up to 75%.
75%?
Well, later, this was in about 1946, on estates worth over £21,500, which again was mega in those days. 1950, it went up to 80%.
So quite a lot of people paid quite a lot more tax than they'd been used to. What was the reaction?
Well, they'd got used to paying quite a lot during the war, and it did. The highest incomes did go up further, and people at the bottom actually were paying less. But I think, you know, in the end, one reason why Labour lost in 1951 was that middle-class people did get fed up with paying so much tax and the continuation of rationing, even though, of course, they were benefiting and were told they were benefiting from a universal national health service and much improved education and generally improved services.
But I do think, sorry, but there's one thing, important thing to say about this, which is that you need really to look at the tax take as a percentage of GDP to see how willing a population is to pay taxes. And if you look at tax revenues as a percentage of GDP, GDP in the UK, it's very, very hard ever to get them up beyond 37-38%. And you have a few occasions just post-war and during the 70s when suddenly you'll see it pop up to 40%. But then you see it fall back down again fairly quickly into the late to mid-30s because you have a cultural resistance, or appear to have a cultural resistance in the UK from the population as a whole to paying more than, say, 36%.
In other words, a cultural notion of what it is fair to take in income tax.
Yeah, you know, wisdom of crowds, in a way. If you start to look, it doesn't matter in the UK how you switch things around, what taxes you raise, what taxes you lower, whether you make income tax, you know, at the highest level, 90%, 60%, 45%, whatever. In the end, you end up with a take somewhere between 34 and 39%-ish. And it's very hard, or appears to be impossible, to push it higher.
I want you to kind of exercise your imagination. Suppose for a moment that I am the incoming chancellor of the next government, whatever a stamp it is. 2 years in, I'm trying to fund all these programmes. I've decided that I'm going to fund the programmes. I'm not going to not deliver on the manifesto. What are my options, given that I am now probably, almost certainly, facing a significant possibility of a shortfall, John Whiting?
Well, income tax, VAT, national insurance, those are your big three taxes. If you want serious money, it's pretty difficult not to look at those. All right, then corporation tax, rates, very good earners. But you've really got to think hard. And I think one of the greatest lessons I would ask you to consider, Chancellor, is the old first do no harm. It is all too easy to just tweak a tax, change a relief, raise a rate, and it has a sudden knock on. If I'm allowed to give you a lesson from history, in the late 18th century, they thought that taxing the manufacture of watches would be a good idea because this was the new trendy symbol of wealth. Well, it was for a few years, but you might notice that the UK doesn't have much of a watch industry. Switzerland does. And what gave the Swiss industry a terrific boost? Answer, UK watchmakers going to Switzerland.
In other words, you can have unexpected impacts, actually, and sometimes that is expected impacts of raising these kinds of imposts. You raise corporation tax and Labour is proposing, but we've got to imagine that what they've raised in corporation tax isn't sufficient. Could you get more out of corporation tax than Labour is even proposing now? And if you did, what would be the consequence? Merrin.
Well, you know, the whole point of everything that Labour, for example, is trying to do is they say that this will lead us to a higher growth economy, but increasing corporation tax will have the opposite effect. So I don't think that's the best way to go at all. No, increasing corporation tax, particularly in a globally competitive corporation tax environment, is not the answer. In the end, if you really want to raise a significant amount more money without completely transforming the tax environment in the UK, you have to go back to income tax. And then if you really want to raise more, you have to go back to the mistake that we might have made over the last 20 years, which is to consistently shift to making the bottom part of the earning population paying less and less and less. So the bottom 50% of the population in 2000 were paying around 13% of income tax. Now they're paying around 10%. 43% of adults in the UK pay no income tax at all. Now, that may be a good thing in theory, but it's also a very bad thing in the end for your income tax receipts. If you want everybody to be paying, you're going to have to reverse that a little bit. Not an attractive idea, but if you really want to raise your tax take, and you know that income tax is where an awful lot of the money comes from, that's where you have to go. You know, right now you've got the top 50% of the earning population paying 90% of the income tax and the top 1% paying 28%. How much more can you get out of them before they start to change their behaviour?
Now, looking at the possibility of taxing wealth that is not income related and whether there are big possibilities there, because a lot of people think that whatever impost we have at the moment on wealth, they're nothing like as significant as they might be. John Whiting.
It is clearly possible by saying that, all right, and again, one harks back to history when they simply said, all right, whatever your wealth, you will pay over a 12th or whatever it is to the Crown. And that immediately, even then, aroused all sorts of questions about how you value it, how you administer it and everything else. Now, if it was put to the British that we're going down that sort of route, a levy on all your assets, but we are getting rid of some of the sort of quasi-wealth taxes like stamp duty on buying property, like possibly council tax, and as much as anything, this is becoming a sort of tax on the assets, well, that's a possible. But then you ask yourself, well, is this, for example, if we're taxing your private company, is this a very good way of actually affecting and taxing business, because potentially they're paying corporation tax. Are you now having to pay on the assets you own? It's a choice you make, but it's an administratively complex one and would be a great scope, I suspect, for my old profession of tax advisors.
But on the other hand, there is an enormous amount of value locked up in wealth, and also actually producing quite a lot of income sometimes on wealth, which is not directly income related. It doesn't come through PAYE. Now, historically, Pat Thane, what have we thought about things like land taxes in this country?
Well, there was a major land tax introduced in 1909 by Lloyd George, who was really greatly expanding the whole tax structure. And that's what caused a big crisis for the House of Lords, who rejected it. But then it was implemented. I think the post-45 government certainly had some kind of land tax. But of course, there have always been property taxes on, because the largest asset most people have is their house. And one way of taxing that is through what used to be local rates and then became council tax. And of course, council tax hasn't been revalued since 1993. And house prices have changed quite a lot since then.
Now, why haven't we revalued property since 1993?
The answer is it's a poison chalice, and successive chancellors are always putting it off until tomorrow. But, I mean, the tax to which Pat alludes, that was still going along into the 60s, an imputed value of your property. A notional rent was charged. So could we go back to that? I suppose we could dust off the records.
Would we raise much money by doing it?
It raised a bit of money. But again, as one of the issues is always ability to pay. The fact that you've got some assets does not mean you've got the income to pay it. So do you start running into the question of allowing people to roll up the tax liability and pay it off later? So, and then, of course, it doesn't necessarily raise as much as you want. And if you start taxing property like that, is that going to cause people to dump property, to go into rentals? Mm. It has all sorts of possible knock-ons which need to be thought through.
Merrin Somerset Webb, what about inheritance tax?
I think inheritance tax is possibly the cruelest of all taxes, not because of its levels, not because of its technicalities, but because there are so many ways to not pay it, or people believe there are so many loopholes, it keeps old people up at night. It keeps them up at night, lying in bed, worrying about how they can avoid this tax, which they believe to be a tax on their death, and prevents them handing their assets on to their children. A much better way to do it would be to abolish inheritance tax, which, to be honest, most countries have, not very many countries have this tax, and introduce instead a gift tax, so that every time cash or assets are exchanged between anybody, be it a family member or not, the recipient pays a tax on it, possibly at their marginal rate of income, because, of course, this is unearned wealth. So if you were to hand over to a child £100,000, £200,000, £10,000, whatever it is, they pay tax on that gift at their marginal rate of income tax. And then suddenly you have a very meritocratic, very progressive, very unavoidable, and this is key, very unavoidable wealth tax that doesn't keep anyone up at night because it is unavoidable.
Well, you've persuaded me, but John, will we raise much money that way?
Well, I mean, time or not, man, it depends on what rate you put it on us, but it is definitely one of the things that's been moot. And if you go back to the capital transfer tax ideas, which Labour introduced originally in the 70s, that was sort of looking at this: when you give something, there is a levy, or when you die and leave something, there is a levy. Both of these are certainly plausible, because the irony of inheritance tax is the really wealthy can avoid it simply by giving large proportions of their estate away. Whereas most of us whose wealth consists of our house and our pension, you can't really give it away.
Well, I was going to say there are ways to increase wealth taxes without, which, by the way, I don't necessarily approve of, but without going through this business of an annual wealth tax, but comes with this horrible problem of ability to pay. And if you want taxes to be simple, straightforward, and this is absolutely key, and have people able to pay them, you must do it at a point of transfer. It has to be done when assets are moved between people. That is the way to get money out of people. So capital gains tax on primary homes is an absolute obvious one, which of course is a great untouchable in the UK. It's absolutely toxic, but nonetheless, that would work.
Pat Thane, putting all that in kind of, you know, historical context of how we thought about wealth, how do you react to those possibilities?
I think we should be careful about generalising about the older generation all having vast amounts of pensions and housing, because there's huge inequality within the older generation. A high proportion of them are really have very low incomes. So there's inequality within generations as well as between them.
Well, I think it's quite interesting if you look at the rise in the conversation around wealth inequality in not just in the UK, but in the US and the rest of the Western world. It is obvious, it is a given, that as a population ages, so does wealth inequality. Because obviously the trickle-down effect, you know, the older people don't, if they die later, then their assets come down later to younger generations. So you will find that the wealth inequality debate in the end, a bit like the income inequality debate as well, by the way, misses the effect of age. So, you know, most people, when they're young, are very asset poor. A large amount of people, when they're older, are what we consider to be very asset rich. And so the longer people live, the worse wealth inequality becomes. And it's the same with income, you know, talking about the man who thought that he was not rich with £80,000. Nobody is born earning £80,000 and then dies earning £80,000. You start at working in a pub at £6 an hour and you work way up, £10,000, £12,000, £15,000, £25,000, £30,000, eventually, if you're lucky, £80,000. But you pass through all these levels of income and wealth as you age, and this is something that I think is very often missed in this debate about taxation, an awful lot of younger people who may like to vote for people on higher incomes to be taxed very heavily should perhaps be careful what they wish for, because that will be their income when they're in their 40s.
I think that's a very good point to put finally to Pat Thane. Looking back on how we thought about income and how we thought about what was fair, one of the things it was based upon was, to be frank, a younger population. There were more people likely to be in the working age than there will be going forward. What does that make you think about wealth going ahead?
Well, I think we can underestimate how much older people contribute to the economy. Those who have got wealth pay taxes and they spend. And also they do contribute a huge amount through voluntary action, which has become more important as the welfare state's been eroded. And in real terms, that's worth quite a lot.
Right, OK. So I'm going to ask each of you, if you had a preference, let's say we know we've got this shortfall and we know what the political constraints are. Merin, you first. What would you do?
I would probably widen out income tax, because I do think that we're in a very difficult position when we have 43% of the working population paying no income tax at all. And, you know, tax works better if you take a little bit from everybody as opposed to a lot from a few people.
John Whiting, what would you do?
Firstly, I'd be honest and open about what I'm doing, which potentially, as Merin says, means raising income tax and being completely open that the rates are going up rather than trying to obfuscate and tweak things here and there. Because if you want serious money, it comes back to income tax, national insurance, VAT. Let's be honest and open with what we are doing.
Pat Thane.
I mean, I totally agree with the other two, that taxing older people and not assuming because you're older you should pay less tax if you've got a decent income. Speaking as one of them who'd be paying, I'd be happy to go along with it.
It is at some point worth the country having a conversation about exactly how much tax and how big a state we want. And in this election, there is no discussion about. The discussion is only about a bigger state, a bigger state, a bigger state. And there's a wonderful new book out on tax which points out that medieval peasants before the Black Death had to spend half their working week working on the land of their lord. So about, you know, 50% of their effective incomes went in tax in exchange for protection. And now, of course, we pay over a working lifetime about 47% of our income in taxation. So if you look at it like that, while we receive rather more back for our contributions, our levels of freedom haven't exactly changed.
But on the other hand, we don't have the Black Death.
No.
Well, they didn't have the Black Death lit either. That came later.
It increased their earning power considerably when the Black Death came, as it happened.
Yes. Okay, well, there's a... Yes. I normally do a kind
cheerful
of...
note.
I normally do a roundup and so on. So the best we can hope for is the Black Death is not one I've expected.
I don't think it's a policy option I would recommend, yeah. Chancellor.
John Whiting there with Pat Thane and Merin Somerset-Webb. My conclusion, if you want to do all this stuff, then something's got to give, and whatever it is, it will cause much dissent. Well, my thanks to Torsten Bell, Merin Somerset-Webb, John Whiting and Pat Thane. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Simon Coates. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.